you so much to our children who have led us in worship just now and the adults who work with them. I am grateful for you sharing your gifts with us. I confess that when I was just a little older than these children, when I was probably a teenager or maybe even a college student, I still wasn't well acquainted with the season of Lent. I remember my reaction the first time at my home church, someone, for whatever reason, it was a low Baptist church that I was raised in, and so someone finally one year mentioned that we were observing Lent. And I remember thinking, because the only thing I could think of was the stuff we had to clean out of the dryer before it was safe to use it the next time. So that was my starting place, and I dare guess for some of you a similar experience if you were willing to own up to it the first time you were introduced to this intentional 40-day season of preparation where we take a journey toward the cross and toward the tomb and the victory and the hope that we find in Jesus. I look around the room, by the way, this morning and can't help but say it is good to see you here. Some of you have been away from us because of responsibilities. Many of you away from us a Sunday here or a Sunday there because of illness. We are complete when you are here. We are incomplete when you are not here. And so it is such a gift to look out and such an encouragement to look out and see you here on this Lord's Day and any Lord's Day that you are here. One of the pillar couples in my Greensboro church were celebrating their 65th wedding anniversary one year. Long since retired now, they had made a successful life for themselves and were looked up to by so many in the community and in our church. Elizabeth and I went by their place for a drop-in reception one afternoon that they were hosting. And while having raised a beautiful family together, he had been a prominent businessman also with a large regional corporation, and so they were known as business people, and people processed their lives through business terminology and business lenses, and they had begun to as well over the years. Someone in the crowd asked them what it felt like to be married for 65 years, and with a smile and a quick sense of humor, she said, "Well, if I'd have known back then that what I was signing on to was long term, I'd have probably renegotiated the deal." I wonder how many contracts or covenants you have in your life. Some of them are obvious because they cost us the largest amounts of money. A lot of us have a mortgage or a rent agreement. We might have a loan balance on a car we're driving. It really means that the bank is letting us live in our home, letting us drive our car, if we pay them the amount we're supposed to and at the time each month that they say that we're supposed to. But the myriad other contracts, other agreements that structure our lives are more subtle, maybe because the stakes don't seem quite so high. If you have a cell phone, you have a contract for service. If you have cable TV or the dish, Wi-Fi or propane gas, you have a contract for every one of these, and there are others if you stop to think about it. They state the expected behaviors of both parties. If you give them what they agreed to give, the theory is they will also provide what they agreed to provide. Clark Howard, the nationally syndicated consumer guru, owns a number of rental properties in his personal portfolio. He cautions, don't go into rental properties unless you're the kind of person who can evict someone for breach of contract, because you will eventually have to if you rent out many of them. I suspect, unfortunately, that he's right, because one reason that contracts exist, ultimately, is because early on, we have learned that we can't trust everyone that we meet. Covenants, at least in the Bible, were different. Covenant is the language we have in our Bible. Covenants are what keep us turning the pages from Genesis through Revelation, that give framework and structure for the chapters of God's interaction with the people depicted there. The Hebrews entered into these sacred agreements as God put them forth, and ultimately they evolved into the Christian covenant in Christ. We enter the season of Lent this week then, and with that marks our journey toward the hope we find as covenantal promises were kept along the way, all the way to the cross and to the tomb. Like the contracts we are used to, covenants are an exchange of promises. In today's law world, I'm told that they are virtually the same. Two words essentially used to mean the same thing. Our homeowners associations in two cities we lived in previous to here had covenants that each resident was required to sign onto and abide by. And of course, we're all used to the language of covenant for our marriage vows that we may have taken. Famously, we talk about the sacred covenant of marriage. And if I unite you in holy matrimony, as is permitted by the state, and you decide later to dissolve that arrangement, you will be reminded that if it was filed, it has become a legal contract that must be undone by the courts. But let's stay with that marriage imagery for a moment. Couples exchange vows or speak agreement to certain terms in the declaration of intent. For richer or for poorer, sickness or in health, better or worse, whatever the terms may be, these are the words of the covenant. We will love and support, we will uphold and help, we will stay with and we will encourage. I don't know about you, but we have lived poorer those first years in seminary and just after. We've lived relatively richer. But we were just as on board for our covenant in both of those. And that becomes the image that we attach ourselves to in biblical covenants. We have not suffered significant illnesses at our house, but we have certainly walked together as parents, and a sibling have suffered illnesses and surgery and even death. And some of those times were not easy, but no one bailed on the other. Covenants in the Bible did not mean that one party would go away if the other party didn't keep the whole agreement between them. Nothing, no one act would just void the entire covenant just because one failed up to live to a term. We human beings disappoint each other all the time. I am not a perfect person, yet Elizabeth has allowed me to stay so far in this covenant despite my failings. Covenants state what is expected of each. They may even involve if-then language, but it may be that the covenants ultimately exist because two parties are choosing and pledging to trust one another. Long before Abraham entered a covenant relationship with the promise of being the father of descendants that number greater than the grains of the sand, Noah received a covenant from God. So we began framing the marvelous chapters of our Bible right up to and beyond the tomb on Easter as taking place under covenant agreements between God and creation. This season of Lent, we will take a journey in these sermons then, or a survey of these covenants for a different perspective on our celebration. I don't have to tell you about floods, do I? If you've been here very long at all, you've lived through one in the area. Even if your house or place of work wasn't damaged directly in the flood, your life was impacted in this region. In 2005, Hurricane Katrina raged into the Biloxi and New Orleans areas. And now in downtown Biloxi, there is a literal wall that stands 23 feet tall, marking the height of the wall of water that washed into their city one day and devastated them, along with the winds that came behind it. For 5 years, we took groups out there, I did, as part of a consortium of churches who banded together to help rebuild. We invested in one church and one neighborhood, setting up a habitat-style rebuild effort to get people back into their homes if they were salvageable. I couldn't tell you how many times I packed up my little air mattress and went out to the church there just outside of Biloxi and slept in Sunday school classrooms as we went in day by day and did drywall and painting and sometimes demolition and sometimes ceiling work floor work, whatever it took to try to make them whole again. And whenever we took a new volunteer out there with us, we would arrive just before dinner. We would enjoy a meal together on that first day, and then we would load any new people and anyone else who wanted to up onto the minibus, and we'd take them for a tour. We wanted them to see the area, the neighborhood that we were going to be working in. We wanted them to see the extent of the damage. And it was never unusual for a new volunteer to be heard sobbing as they rode the bus, because they could see something that only on the news and only in their imagination had they pictured. You may remember that General Honoré was sent out to coordinate the recovery effort in that region. And he said one time in an interview, "I have seen the sting of war. I have seen the devastation that a skirmish can cause. But I've never seen anything like this in my life." He said a war exists of skirmishes that are usually confined to a set region, an area. And then around that, things look fairly normal. But he said this thing seemed to have no end, no boundaries, nothing that would slow it down. The devastation is so complete, so widespread. Many ancient civilizations had accounts of a catastrophic flood way back. In our Bible, Genesis was just such an account. It seems that God became disillusioned with humanity, and as it is portrayed, sent a flood to wipe out the earth. Today we would call it a reboot, a reset button that God pressed. God essentially started over, saved Noah's family and two of every species on the ark. My friend and biblical professor at McAfee School of Theology, Lloyd Allen, says that in the biblical flood story, God uncreates the Edenic world, preserves a remnant of that original creation, and reestablishes the cosmos under a new order. For a story that we relegate mostly to the realm of children's Sunday school and vacation Bible school, when you put it like that, doesn't it sound like children of all ages would do good to revisit it for a moment? What can we possibly learn from this that is inspiring, though? And what can this have to do with the approaching Easter a few weeks from now? We don't feel good about this flood. This account in our Bible raises literally more questions than it probably answers. Our scripture today won't help us, for instance, with why God did such a thing at that time. It picks up after that. Genesis 6, verse 11 through 14, comes as close as we may get to an explanation. The earth was filled with violence, and God saw that the earth was corrupt, for all flesh had corrupted its ways upon the earth. And yet that does not really satisfy our curiosities, our questions. After 150 days, the waters had receded, and eventually Noah and all who were with him stepped once again onto the ground. It was no real prize they had won, since things were now barren and depressing. Personally, just for my part, God could have left the mosquitoes off the ark. Maybe the hornets that sting and attack. I'm still not too sure about the snakes either, for that matter. Why would God do such a thing to the earth? How bad must it have been? Could it have been that much worse than some of the things we think we find discouraging today? If you listen, you might hear it. Not the cooing of the dove who flies back in with an olive branch in its mouth after a time. Not the lowing of a cow munching on some tender green grass that has begun to shoot up from the ground in the aftermath of the flood. And not even the barking of a dog as it ran free finally from its confinement aboard the ark. No, this sounds different from any of those. This was the sound of a God who realized that this outcome did did not seem to be any better than the sin and degradation that had preceded it. God was remorseful, it sounds like. I will never again curse the ground because of humankind. For the inclination of the human heart is evil from youth, nor will I ever destroy every living creature as I have done. And I don't want to take that sense of regret too far. I know some aren't comfortable with the notion of God changing minds, yet that is what is portrayed here in Genesis. Ultimately, you'll have to figure out for yourself how to make meaning of that. But here is the voice of God, not spewing hate or anger, but a tender and vulnerable promise that reveals deep love. God, on the one hand, seems here to raise a shrug and concede that humankind simply isn't perfect. Humankind has a proclivity to living in ways that aren't ideal, aren't healthy. And sometimes we can just be downright rebellious and selfish. Do you ever consider, though, that even God sometimes has mixed emotions about something? Paul Rock says of this text, God had been saddened enough with the actions of humanity to destroy them, but God was also saddened by the destruction the flood had caused. I will never again wipe out the earth with a flood, kill all the animals, just because of what the humans have done. So the rainbow was set in place in the clouds as a sign and as a reminder of the promise God made here. But if you think God had enjoyed the punishment of the flood, read your scriptures again. So comprehensive is God's love for every living creature that this covenant after the flood did not just apply to humans, but to all living creatures that crawled, flew, or swam upon the earth. It's hard to read this and come away feeling casual about our human stewardship of all the earth and its resources. Somehow, though, we skip right over this covenant and start with Abraham or Moses when we think of God's binding agreements. Those are the ones we think of, but covenants pretty much started here. Jane Ann Ferguson tells the story of a young mother who was taking a walk with her small son when they saw a rainbow, and the 4-year-old boy looked up and in his wonder said, "Mommy, can we take that home and put it in our house?" And his awestruck question prompted the mother to write a poem that she entitled, "A Rainbow in My House." She took her son's question literally, imagining what it would be like to have a rainbow in her house, on their walls, emanating from the windows and doors, coming out of the chimney because the house could not hold the grandeur of this beautiful thing. And we, like that 4-year-old boy, sometimes we want to take the rainbow with us. If we're honest, we want to prolong that feeling we get when we look up in the sky and see one. And Lloyd Allen reminds us that in that covenant, God accepted self-imposed and unilateral boundaries. As for me, verse 9, never, never, never again a flood. God places a restraining order against God's self. But God also reveals in this covenant an intense and deep-seated love for all of creation, in that God will resume a practice of freedom with hope, freedom of choice, the ultimate act of love that God could have committed, along with the hope that humanity will take on more responsibility to live in a healthful balance with each other and with creation. So was God resolving never again to punish us? Depends on what you believe about God. If you read on in your Bibles, you'll remember that there are more covenants to come. There are also, though, chapters and writings like Judges and the prophets that fill the pages of the Old Testament that show us some features of this new covenantal relationship. And others that we'll look at in these weeks as we make our way toward the cross of Jesus and the tomb. So in resolving not to punish all of creation just for what humanity did, no more floods, did God just let us loose, knowing how imperfect we could be? Did God simply unleash us on the earth with no fear of recourse? No. A loving God gave us freedom. But watch with me in these weeks to come. God may have moved past the flood with an even tougher punishment in mind from now on. For God would do the one thing to us that should send chills up and down our spines. Moving forward, God would grant us the lavish and loving freedom even to sin, and then suffer the consequences of our own choices in our lives. That slow flood of freedom, choice, justice, and pain washes over the rest of the Old Testament story right in front of us in the pages of our Bible. Let loose upon the earth humanity ever since with freedom, but responsibility too. We will never be free of life's pain because the natural world and others have free choice too. Important to you and me though, and this is where I hold for today, God will not abandon us. But one possibility for what we do with this covenant is fairly simple to understand and profoundly hard to live. That is, make healthier choices and live in somewhat less strife. So come back with me and let's keep walking through the Bible on these Sundays as we move toward the power of the cross, so that we'll appreciate anew the grace and hope we find in Jesus Christ when His time had finally come. And if we do that, we will have spent the season of Lent as it was intended. Our hymn of response is on page 522 in your hymnal. O Christ, the way, the truth, the life is its title. This may be a day on which you want to make a renewal in your heart. This may be a day in which you need to come and see me down front and let me help you to get ready to make a new commitment in the life of this church and in your spirit. This may be a time when you respond by letting the words of the hymn guide you. Whatever may be your case, hymn number 22, O Christ, the way, the truth, the life, stand as you are able.